Hello and good evening from Yerushalayim HaKodesh. As we begin Masechet Rosh Hashanah, where the Mishnah begins, Rechav Nisan Rosh Hashanah L'Mlachim V'Lergolim, and the Gemara explains L'Mlachim is that it's the beginning of the year for the king, which means no matter when the king was appointed, when Aleph Nisan comes, it's already a new year. As the Gemara says in that base of a base, if the king was appointed on Chodesh Adar, Aleph Nisan is already considered his second year. And the Gemara goes into details to explain Machlokes Rashi and Tosfos, but Rashi explains that if he would not have a set date for the beginning of the new year, so then later times people might be confused. They'll see a star, and one star says Cheshvan, one star says Teves, and there'll be no way of knowing which one was written first, because if the king was appointed in Kislev, so then the star in Teves was first. But if he was appointed after Teves, so then the star in Cheshvan was first. So today we're going to discuss the old systems and the new systems of how to make documents, how they used to write documents in such a way that people would know which is the early document, which is the late document. First, we're going to start a little to do with the months. We know we have our Hebrew names for the months, Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, Teves, but they weren't always with that name. In Tanakh, we have three names of months mentioned: Yerach HaYisanim, which is Tishrei; we have Yerach Bul, which is Cheshvan; and we have Yerach Ziv, which is Iyar. Those are the three mentioned in Tanakh. There's no other names mentioned of the months, of the Hebrew months. The Ramban explains in Parshas Bo that the months would be more referred to as Chodesh HaRishon, Chodesh Sheni, Chodesh Shlishi, just like the days of the week in Hebrew do not have specific names, Yom Rishon, Yom Sheni, etc. So the emphasis was not on a special name for the month, but rather Chodesh HaRishon, Chodesh Sheni, Chodesh Shlishi. This continues, as we'll see, until Golos Bavel. A very interesting artifact that was discovered in a place called Tel Gezer. Tel Gezer is not far from Tel Aviv. If you have your source page, source number 7, it has a picture of the stone tablet that was found in excavations in Gezer in 1908. Unfortunately, the thing was found in a pile of dirt after an excavation, so no one knows for sure which period it belongs to, what it seems to belong to. The Gezer was a city that was captured by Paro and given to Shlomo as a dowry, and it seems to be belonging to that time period from the time of Shlomo HaMelech. And this is a very interesting stone with an inscription on it, and the inscription carries the name of months, and the months over here are all agricultural months. It's definitely a Hebrew writing, in other words, when the Israelites lived in Canaan. And to go through the whole detail, how exactly the dating system of the writing is very complicated, but let's see what the list has for us. On the list, it says like this. Yarchei, at least 8 months with names, but 4 of the months are listed instead of Yerach, they're listed with Yarchei, as in plural. So that gives us a total of 12 months. Yarchei Asif, 2 months of gathering. Now we know that the gathering wasn't the time of Tishrei, so clearly this is a calendar that begins from Rosh Hashanah time. Yarchei Asif, Yarchei Zera, 2 months of planting. Yarchei Lakish, 2 months probably have to do with Malkosh, with the end of the main, so there we have 6 months. Yerach Atzid Pishta, which probably means a month that they reap the flax. Now flax, although today does not grow at all in Eretz Yisrael, but in ancient times it grew very commonly until the Islamic period, until the Islamic conquest in the year 638. And for example, we have in Yehoshua by Rechav, when she hid the spies, but this man befishte ha'etz haruchos la'alagat, she hid them in the stalks of the flax that were on the roof, and that took place in Nisan. Sometimes it took place at the end of the rainy period when the flax was already picked and put up on the roof to dry. In a place not far from there, Vadi Makuk, they found from the Galilithic period, going back 4,000 years ago, they found a linen shroud 8 meters long. which probably came from somewhere there, off of Mengedi. So growing flax was common in Eretz Yisrael in those days, and 1 month of picking the flax. After that comes Yerech Katsiras Ha'orim, 1 month of picking the barley, and that is probably the month of Yer. Then we have Yerech Katsir V'cheu, the month of harvesting, which we assume, if it doesn't mention specifically, it's talking about wheat, and V'cheu is the measure. Yerechei Zamir, 2 months of Zamira, which probably has to do with reaping the with picking the grapes from the vines, and the last month is Yerech Kites or Yerech Kites, which is when they take the figs and put them to dry. In modern Hebrew, Kites means summer. It gets its name from the time they used to dry the figs. So we have a calendar over here, actually, of 12 months. The man it seems at first, but as we show, it's a calendar of 12 months, and all these months have to do with the agricultural seasons. It does remind us of the Gemara Bava Metzia, where it talks about in Parshas Nachot, Kolim Me'ar, Adzera, V'Katsir, V'Kor, V'Chom, V'Kayitz, V'Choref, where we give each of those 2 months. There are similarities between that and what we have over here on this calendar. So this is a calendar of months. I'm not sure if it's Hebrew months. That's maybe some farmer who just wanted to keep track of where he's up to, whatever. But this is a very interesting document. We'll get back to the months. We will get back to the months later on. We're talking about calculating the years. So the years were calculated to the reign of the king. We do not have any document, any archaeological document from the first Beis Hamikdash period where it mentions the name and years of the king. What's interesting, for example, is the famous Shiloh inscription, the inscription which Chizkiyahu HaMelech put in the famous tunnel that he dug in Yerushalayim, 530 meters, was dug from both ends, they met in the middle, and at the end of the tunnel, there was an inscription today, it's sitting in the museum in Istanbul, together with the Gezer calendar, and it mentions how the digging progressed, and how it was concluded, and the water was flowing and everything. One thing very interestingly missing is the name of the king and the year of the king. It doesn't say who did it. There are some still claim it could have been done in the Hashmonai period, etc. Today, very few believe that, but there are, and it leaves room for speculation because it doesn't have a name. You'd expect a king who did such an accomplishment, and it is an amazing accomplishment, you'd expect him to put his name up there. I, King Christio, in the year so-and-so of my reign, I completed this. That's what we'd expect, but it doesn't appear there. As I said, there are no documents, to my knowledge, from the first Beis Hamikdash where it mentions a year, whatsoever. You mentioned two sets of documents that one is from the city of Lachish, which is south of Beit Shemesh, and another is from the city of Arad. Some documents carry military instructions or whatever, but none of them carry a number of of a year, etc. On the other hand, there are the documents from that time that do carry years are those that are found in Shomron. When Shlomo HaMelech passed away, the Malchus split into two. The 10 Shvatim of the north made their own kingdom, and eventually the capital city, although wandered from place to place, eventually the capital city became the city of Shomron. And in Shomron, excavations were carried out in a few places, and on the Acropolis, the top of the hill of Shomron, in the basement, they found a bunch of pottery shards with inscriptions on them, and they basically talk about collections of wine and stuff like that that were brought. It seems that these things were brought as taxes. Taxes were paid in those days in commodities, not in any form of money. And they carry names of families, names of places where they came from, and years. Bishnas Sheis, etc., in the year 6 and whatever. But it does not say in the year 6 of whose reign or whatever. So therefore, we assume that it's reigns of king, and that doesn't leave too many possibilities with the amount of years that appear over there, but it's very hard to know for sure, because it does not carry the names of the kings, but this is the first mention of in archaeological documents that we have of years probably to the kings. Okay. We go on to the end of the first Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash is destroyed by the Bavliim, by the Babylonians, and Bnei Yisrael are in Golus Babel for 70 years. And 70 years. And this had an effect on the calendar. On the one hand, one of the main things that had an effect on the calendar, and this we have the source code over here in the Hebrew source pages 1.1 from the Yerushalmi, the Amav Chanina. Shmos Chadashim Ola B'yadam Yibavel. The names of the months were Ola B'kla Yisrael from Babel. And that's what Chazal say, that we know that the year begins in Tishrei, and nonetheless the first month of the year is Nisan. So how to reconcile the two? So the Ramban already explains his famous drasha, which he gave in Akko on Rosh Hashanah in the year 1270, probably explains that really Bria Sa'olam is in Tishrei, but when Klal went out of Mitzrayim, Chodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodesh. Hashem said that we start counting from Nisan. So Nisan is the first month. So Nisan is the first month, but later on, and as the Yerushalmi says over here, Shmos Chodeshim Olam B'yadam Yibavel, the names of the months that we have today, Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, etc., those are names of months that came from Babel. Now the Ramban himself says that they actually came from Persia. We'll see that the archaeological evidence does point to Babel indeed. Why did we adapt the names of the Babylonian names of the months? Because to commemorate the fact that we came back from Golus Babel, that Hashem brought us from Golus Babel, so we mentioned the Yishva. So that's what our man says. It's more shaykh to the Persians because they're the ones who granted us permission to come back. We have in the pictures two interesting documents. We have source number 10 on the picture page. It has a tablet with Babylonian months. And this tablet is in the British Museum, not on display anymore. It was on display. And this is a list of something very similar like the Gezer calendar, although the Gezer calendar probably was not anything royal. It was local farmer. Well, this is probably some form of royal tablet where it mentions the months. And the months are very similar to the way we know them today, with a couple of discrepancies. For example, it's called Abu, Adar is Adaru, and Kislev is Kislemu. All very easy to see that they are the same names of the months that we have today. Another tablet, which I don't see the source over here, the Babylonian chronology, which also is in the British Museum on display, in which it talks about the events that took place during the years of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And it runs only in the first period of his reign. It doesn't run to the Churban Beis HaMikdash. From the year 7, the year 8, it talks about where he went into, he launched an assault on the city of Judah, which is presumably Yerushalayim, and he began in Kislamu, and he completed the conquest of Yerushalayim in Adaru, which means a 3-month job, and he took the king, and with a lot of spoils to Babylon, and appointed a new king of his liking. And this seems to be implying we're talking about the Golas of Yechoniah, that King Yechoniah, we know, was taken into Golas Babel early in the 11 years before the Korban, and that's when he appointed Tzidkiyahu to be the next king. We do not have the continuation of this tablet, so we don't know. This is a tablet that was written much later, reflecting Babylonian history. We don't have the tablet of the years that he destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. So it does leave a void, in, archaeologically speaking, as far as that. But the year mentioned over there, if I remember correctly, is 8, and in Tanakh, one place it says it happened in the 7th year, another place it says it happened in the 8th year. The Gemara explains how the discrepancy, but clearly we're talking about this Golas of Yechoniah. And again, those names, the Babylonian names of the months, Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, etc., again, not perfectly, but with some discrepancies. Another thing the Babylonians had, and now we will not go into over here, is the system of leap years, which is very similar to the system of leap years that we have today, 7 out of 19, except that they used to make 1 year, they made a leap year in Elul instead of making it another. Because in 1 year, when it's pretty early to make it, probably the 8th year, it's probably too early to make it, so they used to make a leap year in other instead of other. So, Okay, so that's the that's the impact that the Babylonians have in the calendar, the name of the months. I also had some document, but it's not up, unfortunately, but not important. The Elephantine papyri documents from a place called Elephantine, which is today Aswan in Egypt. There was a Jewish there was a group of Jewish soldiers under the Persian king, and a bunch of very interesting documents, which we will not elaborate on. But the documents carry the Babylonian months and the Egyptian months, as they are, we know the Persian government is very tolerant, Medina, Medina, Kusava, Ba'am, Ba'am, Toshono, so it carries both names, the months of Tammuz, for example, and the Egyptian months, and it's during the reign, most of it's during the reign of King Artaxerxes, who we're going to discuss in a moment. So again, these are, this we can say is the first document that actually, that we have, a Jewish document, that mentions the reign of a king, although he's not a Jewish king. King Artaxerxes. But we do see from those documents that the Persian kings were very, emperors rather, were very tolerant to the Jewish people and granted them freedom of worship, etc., as we know from Sefer Ezra and the Megillah. Okay, we get to the Persian period. The Persian period is, as far as the length of the Persian period, is very complex, and we're not going to solve all those problems today. But we have the Gemara Shonet of Gimel Tana, Hu Koresh, Hu Daryavesh, Hu Artaxerxes. The Gemara says that King Koresh and King Daryavesh and King Artaxerxes are all one. Koresh Melech Kosher Haya. Koresh, because he was a Kosher king. Artaxerxes is the name of his kingdom, and his name was Daryavesh. So now, what the Gemara says, that when in Sefer Ezra over there, we have references to Daryavesh, to Koresh, and Artaxerxes, we're all talking about one king. This thing caused considerable confusion, and takes us to a major issue on understanding the chronology of the second Beis Hamikdash. So let's go on to source number 2:1. Where the Gemara talks about the second Beis Hamikdash. The Gemara says the second Beis Hamikdash stood for 420 years. Tanah Rabbi Yosi Rabbi Machos Parsha from Abay Shloshim Va'Abashon. The Persian, the second Beis Hamikdash stood for 34 years on the Persian rule. Machos Yabon from Abay Shmeir Shmonim Shana, 180 years under the Greek rule. Machos Hashmonai from Abay Shmeir Shalosh under the Hashmonai dynasty 103, and Machos Beis Hardos from Abay Shalosh. And under the Herodian dynasty, another 103. Total, what we have is 420 years. So the Gemara says here, and this Gemara appears in numerous places, as in the next section also, and all over, that the second Beis Hamikdash stood for 420 years. Here's where the fun begins, we could say, because based on Greek historians and others, science does not accept this and claim that the Persian Empire lasted a lot longer than these 34 years that Chazal mentioned. And in essence, they add another 150, 165 years to the Persian period, putting the second Beis Hamikdash close to 600 years. Josephus, for example, he puts it at even more than 600 years. This is a very complex subject, and we're not going to go into the pros and cons, the proofs and counterproofs, because it's a very complicated subject. I just can say pretty much that there is no compelling archaeological evidence to the scientific method of calculation. Now, compelling archaeological evidence is pretty hard to see, unless we're going to find an actual document that says this king ruled this and this king ruled this, etc. From that time, it's impossible to have compelling evidence in either direction. So when I say that, you know, I'm pretty much steering clear from almost all the from all the trouble. But I can tell you an interesting story that happened to me. I was in, a couple of years ago, this guy worked out in Cambry Avenue. He worked out the whole calculation, and he's a bucky, his name is Shai Walter. He's a big bucky in the astronomy, and he figured out all the eclipses that took place. And based on the eclipses and the historian and the Greek historians recording of events, he came to the conclusion that the Greek historian way of calculating history is correct. because the way these eclipses took place, so it had to, and the Greek historians say which events took place when, based on the eclipses, so we know when the eclipses took place, and therefore we know, and everything is set and fine. I was in the British Museum, I spoke to one of the top people in the Near East Department, and I asked him a question. I said, is there any way we can actually tinker with the Persian history or not? So he smiled to me and said, look, I'll tell you the truth. If you would ask me this question 4 years ago, I'd say absolutely not, because we all have, and based on the eclipses, we know that everything happened. He says, but today I know that the truth is that when the King Ptolemy in the first century rewrote to set up the Greek history, he first made a framework based on the eclipses, and then took all the events that happened and fit them into the framework that he had made. So it's not that we have first-hand documentation that this event took place within relative to certain eclipse, but it's rather they knew the system of eclipses, and the Babylonians knew that also. Babylonians were very big mumchim in the calendar, and Rambam gives them a lot of, and Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh gives them a lot of weight. So he said to me, he says, that the eclipses don't really, I didn't mention anything about eclipses, but he says, the eclipses don't really prove anything because this is the stuff has been rewritten later on to fit into the eclipse, I think. One interesting point that I will bring over here, and again, this was way beyond the scope of the shiur to go in and solve all these problems over all the contradictions here, but if we go into picture source number 11, we have the tomb of Dergavesh, and this is in a place called Naqsh Erustam, which is not far from the Persepolis. The Persepolis is where one of the Persian big palaces were, and the Persepolis was destroyed by Alexander the Great. Around the year 321 BC, I'm not exactly sure on the year, but somewhere within that vicinity. And nearby, there are four royal tombs. Now, according to Chazal, we're talking about four Persian emperors. First of all, it's Koresh, and after that comes Dariavesh, after that comes Achashverosh, and after that comes King Artaxerxes. And when Chazal over here say that Koresh and Dariavesh and Artaxerxes are all one, it doesn't mean that the Koresh, from the one who let the Jews go back and build Beis HaMikdash, is the same Artaxerxes who years later let him build the second Beis HaMikdash. No, that's not what it means. It means that the mention of Koresh and Dariavesh and Artaxerxes in Ezra is referring to one king. But it doesn't mean that there were no couple other kings. So, bottom line is we have five royal tombs. One is the tomb of Koresh in a place called Pasargadeh, and another four royal tombs in a place called Naqsh Erustam. Which one of them is labeled Dariavesh, one we assume is Achashverosh, and one is Artaxerxes, and another king. We don't have enough royal tombs to fit all the list of Persian kings based on the way the scientific world accepts the Greek method of calculating the history. We don't have enough royal tombs. Although, again, archaeology can be very tricky, because somewhere around the corner from there, there are three more tombs, which could be royal tombs, could be tombs for queens, could be anything. We can't rule out the possibility that other kings were going to be buried there. But in Naqsh Erustam, where we know for sure, and Darius's tomb, Darius the Great, has his name on it, so we know for sure this is royal tombs, we only have three more, which fit more with Chazal. Okay, according to Chazal, there should only be two more. It could be some king was about to rule, he already made himself a grave. Again, archaeology is far from an exact science to see, but again, that the amount of tombs over there is one example of archaeological evidence which matches Chazal's calculation. There are a couple of groups of documents that were found. One, as I mentioned, in El Fantini. Another found in a place, Chebet El Kom, near Hebron, which also match more Chazal's chronology than the scientific world's chronology. I'm not going to go into full detail, but one of the suggestions to match the discrepancy is that the Greeks are beginning the story of the Persians long before the Persians became an empire, long before they controlled Babylon, long before they're controlling the Jewish people. So when the Jewish people are counting their history, they're counting 70 years for Babel, and the Persians come in only after the 70 years of Babel. But it could be that the stories that the Greeks are talking about happened 50, 100 years before, when the Persians and the Greeks were fighting it out while the Babylonians were still controlling B'nai Israel. Now, this is an approach by a person by the name of Chaim Chayfetz. Again, it's way beyond the scope to go into the details and try to sort everything out, but this approach basically tries to reconcile a little between the 34 years that Chazal give over here. Now, remember, the 34 years that Chazal give over here are from the time that the second Beis HaMikdash was built, which is a good 18 years after they already defeated the Babylonians, and give them another 6 years until Dariush was killed by Alexander the Great. So we're not talking with just 34 years, we're already talking close to 60 years that they controlled Bnei Yisrael. And as I said, they existed as some kingdom beforehand, but they don't go into the calculation of Bnei Yisrael. Okay, since we mentioned this Gemara, we will tie this in a little to Hanukkah. Let's take a look at Hebrew source 2.3. The Rambam says like this: Revai Sheni, in the second verse of Mikdash, when the Yavanim became they made the zeros and caused a lot of trouble. And then the Rambam ends 2 lines before the end: V'gavu bnei Chashmonai l'kohanim hagadolim v'arogim. And the bnei Chashmonai were victorious over the Greeks. Roshi Yisom Yadam. And they appointed a king from the Kohanim because the Malchus of Yisrael, Yisrael Masayim Shana. And from now on, the Malchus came back to Klai Yisrael more than 200 years until the Churban of the second Beis HaMikdash. So the Rambam lists Malchus Yisrael for another 200 years, and this is based on the source that we had before, that Malchus Chashmonai of Nambayis is 103 years, and Malchus Hardus of Nambayis is another 103 years. That gives you 206 years that it's Jewish Malchus Yisrael. While clearly from the Gemara, 180 years before the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, the Romans already controlled the country. Hardus, we know, was a Roman vassal king underneath the he was Jewish to some extent, but he's ruling under the Romans. And still, the Rambam counts are very interesting there as Malchus Yisrael. Okay, just a side point for Hanukkah. Until the Persian period, as we said, the calculation of years went based on the reign of the king. So-and-so to the year of the king, so-and-so to the year of the king. And from here, it gets that's why things get complicated. You have to know each king when he ruled, and you have to know the neighboring country, the king over there when he ruled. It gets very complicated. The Seleucids created a new form of counting. And their form of counting was they began counting year 1, 2, 3, 4, and counting continuously. They will not have a new calculation when a king is appointed. This is known in the Gemara as Minyan Shtaros. And we have a quote over here, 2:4, Bagola in Manim el Malchi Ivanim Levant. That in the Gola, in Bavel, in outside of Eretz Yisrael, you only use the minion of Malchus Yevanim. And this the Gemara talks about in Gittin also, that when you write a get, you use the calculation of Malchus Yevanim. Why Malchus Yevanim? The Malchus Yevanim have long been gone, and we're still using their calculation. Why? Because this is the first time that there's a straight calculation and through successive. Not every time a new king, a new calculation. And this system continued and continued for hundreds of years afterwards. And the simple system is that take the Hebrew year, which is now 5767, subtract 3449. Now, as in the year 3449 is when the Seleucid calculation began. I think we have one of the sources over there where you can click on to get the to get a page of the basic of, I can see it, the basic, yes, there it is, Seleucid counting, sources 5 and 6, the basic, where you can get the basic idea of the Seleucid form of counting. And this is called Minyan Shtaros in Chazal. This is called Minyan Shtaros in Rishonim. And this system continued ever since Bagola in Chutzlars. Not necessarily in Eretz Yisrael, but in Chutzlars, the Minyan Shtaros became the minyan to calculate successively. And since then, there are very few problems in figuring out which year events happened, because based on Minyan Shtaros, it's very easy to figure that out. So that kind of solved the problem. Although, as the Gemara says, Bagola, in Eretz Yisrael, that's not the way, and we'll see that they continue counting based on Jewish kings or Jewish events. In the Hebrew source page, back to 3-1. We have a very interesting document. This is a document I get. I hope it's also posted in picture number, source number 12. This is a get, a document that was found in Masada. No, it wasn't found in Masada, sorry, but it was written in Masada. This is the oldest get that we have, and it says like this. B'yachod l'macheshvan. On the first of Macheshvan, Shnas Sheis, year 6, b'Masada. Shavach m'tarach m'ndati yom adana. I'm divorcing from my own will. Yosef and Mitzada, I was sitting in Mitzada, Chiyintasi, my wife Miriam, Bras Yehochanan, etc. And from you're able to marry whoever you want. A typical get, which has in it the text that's mentioned in Gemara Gittin, Harayim Tarsu Choladam, and then Tevachim Minoy, the basics of a get, written in Aramaic. Also very interesting over here that it carries the name of Mitzada in Aramaic with an Aleph, which means that the Hebrew name should probably be Mitzad. And the Aramaic name is Mitzada. I already raised the possibility they should change the name to give it a Hebrew name. So far, no luck. But anyway, this is a very interesting document. A, just for the value of it, that we have the oldest get document that we have, which is, again, the basic text used to this very day in unfortunate circumstances. But also the dating over here. Be'achad ha-macheshvan shnas sheis b'metzada, the sixth year. So what are we talking about, the sixth year over here? It's most probably the sixth year of the Jewish revolt against the Romans. Now, the Jewish revolt against the Romans lasted for 5 years, and it began probably from Nisan, and the fifth year began from Nisan before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Which means coins from the fifth year are very rare, because very few were minted between Nisan and Av when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. But, as we know the story, the Jews continued to live in Masada, and this is from the sixth year in Masada. Sixth year would mean that this took place a year and a half after the Churban. But we'll soon see that that's not so clear. Anyway, what we see over here is that the method of calculating that they used, even after the Churban, is still using the years to the Jewish revolt, even though the Beis HaMikdash was probably no longer standing. So this is a document, we get from Masada. Another interesting document comes from the Jewish revolt against the Romans in the days of Bar Kokhba, and that we're talking about is in the year 132 to 135. And here we have in the Hebrew source page 4.1, we have the text of the document. And by the way, the term Cheshvan doesn't appear anywhere, it's always Ma Cheshvan, that's one word. On the 28th of Macheshvan, Shnat Shalosh, the Shimon Bar Kokhba Nesi Yisrael. The third year of Shimon ben Kosva, Nasi Yisrael, we'll talk about that in a moment, Be'en Gedi, in the city of En Gedi, these documents are found near En Gedi, Ratzu v'chilku b'nosam, and it's on a whole list of how they divided two people, a bunch of people divided up a field or a produce from a field, which was in En Gedi. So, it mentions the name of the person, Shimon bar Kosva. Shimon bar Kosva is known, is otherwise known as Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba, by the way, does not appear anywhere in any Jewish source. In Jewish sources, it was called Bar Kuziva. Bar Kokhba is a Christian concept. His real name seems, as we see from documents over here, Bar Kokhba, seems those who believed he was Mashiach gave him the name Bar Kokhba. Those who believed he wasn't gave him the name Ben Kuziva. Okay, that's not important for us now. What's important for us over here is the year. Once again, Shnat Shalosh, the year, the third year of the revolt. How long did the revolt last? The revolt lasted for 2.5 years, according to the Gemara. Now, this is one document, but another document that was found carried the fourth year of the revolt. Now, the fourth year of the revolt already creates problems. If we assume that the beginning of the revolt is the month of Nisan, so then, even if the revolt began, let's say, in Adar, so 2 years plus later, you're already, you run into the third year. You run into the third year in the next Nisan. And there's no way that you get to the fourth year of the revolt, no matter what. In order to get to the, you need another year. Well, it cannot be in 2.5 years. A very interesting article was written by Rav Goren about this, and I have the source over here. We can find it. Second. If you mind the source of the article, Rabbi Gordon, where he went and a site called in a magazine called Machanaim, and it appears today on a site called Dot AC.IL, and he wrote, okay, I don't see it over here, unfortunately, but on the site called Dot, it lists, it's an article, it's being posted, an article by Rav Gordon goes into this whole question. How could there be a fourth year of a revolt in Cheshvan, in En Gedi, when the whole revolt lasted for 2.5 years? Yeah, the whole Arichos, but I really think the answer to this is very tricky. And the answer is that all these documents that were found in Nachal Chevra, which were finally published 30 years later in entirety, not just the text, were all shtaros mekusharim, were all shtaros that were tied, not shtaros pshutim. And shtaros mekusharim, the Gemara tells us in Masechta Bava Basra that you always add a year to the calculation. So if the year is 3, it would say 4. So when it says 4, it really means the third year. And with the third year, it could be that this Cheshvan is 2 months after Beit HaFel. So it's true, Beit HaFel was the end of the Bar Kokhba revolt, but that doesn't mean that people couldn't have been living in En Gedi and still using that old counting that that used to be. So it's like a Masada, even after Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, Masada is still counting. So that's not, that is not impossible. And that would also mean the get from Masada, which is also Shtar Mekusha, would also still place it after the Churban, because it's in the month of Cheshvan, but 2 months after the Churban, and not a year plus after the Churban. So that's important to know. Okay, so we see that B'nai Yisrael over here are counting the years to the Jewish revolt. Later periods, they're counting the years from the Churban Beis HaMikdash. And for that, we have a couple tombstones over here. The Torah tombstones, these two big pictures over here, source 1 and source 2. These are tombstones from a city called Tzoar. Tzoar is that city from the days of Lot, when Lot took refuge. And after the Churban Beis HaMikdash, and probably during the Churban Beis HaMikdash, during the time of the Second Beis HaMikdash, there was a large Jewish population there. Tombstones from that cemetery have been popping up on the archaeological market all over the place. A couple can be found in the Israel Museum. A couple can be found in the Torah Museum in Borough Park. They have found the dozens of such tombstones. And what's interesting about these tombstones is that they have two methods of calculation. One is the years of the Churban, and another is the years of Shemitah. So it says so-and-so to the year of Churban, so-and-so to the year of Shemitah. Shemitah, of course, was crucial. They kept Shemitah even after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. And these years appear. The big problem with it is that dates don't always match. In other words, if it says year so-and-so to Churban is so-and-so for Shemitah, and you have another stone that'll have another year, and that won't match with the dates of Shemitah. So it's a very complicated thing to try to prove from there. The accuracy of the date of Shemitah is a complex thing because they don't always match. We're not going to go into that because there's a lot written on that too, but that's an important piece of evidence. Okay, what's interesting is that the method that we have today, that we count Levriya Sa'olam from when the world was created, is relatively a later system. It's relatively a later system, and the earliest mention we have from that is the Shul in Susia, which over here is source number four. It doesn't show you the text of the mosaic can be found on the if you could follow that link. The text of the mosaic can be found over there. You see a picture of the mosaic, but you don't exactly see the text. And on this text, it has A, the year of Shemitah, and B, it has the year of Yisrael for the counting of the world. Now, this mosaic is probably from the 5th, 6th century, the earliest, maybe even perhaps even a little later. It's the earliest mention of Yisrael. The big unfortunate circumstances are that we do not have the entire inscription, and the exact years have been are erased, and therefore from there we cannot know what year exactly it was and what year Shemitah was. So this is the first mention of using from Bria's Olam, which is a system that we use today, but as far as the Shemitah is concerned, we don't have the exact data. What's the issue with Shemitah? Over here in the Hebrew source page, 5.1 and 5.2, we don't have time to go through the whole thing, but the Rambam, based on the Gemara, that the Gemara says that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in the post-Shemitah year. And the Rambam understood the Gemara to mean that the year after that was the post-Shemitah year. And then let's not get into the whole details. And therefore the Rambam comes to the conclusion that a certain year, which he lists, his year, Leminyan Shtaros, and for years from the Churban, etc., is Eishnat Shemitah. But then the Rambam continues and says, and all the Gaonim, though, say that they have a tradition not like that. And therefore, the year we're in now is actually Matzah Shemitah. That was the Beis HaMikdash itself was destroyed a year earlier in the cycle of Shemitah than I thought, and I understood the Gemara. So Rambam says, I understand the Gemara to mean this, but the Gaonim and all the Chachmei Eretz Yisrael and Anshei Eretz Yisrael say it doesn't go like that. And according to them, we're in the Shemitah year now. And the Rambam concludes, and according to this Cheshbon, we calculate today. In other words, even though I don't think that this is right, but the Masoret, the tradition, overrides what I think. And since the tradition is, in other words, they have continuity. The earliest document that we have that actually ties in before the Rambam, that ties the exact year of Bria's Olam to Shemitah, is found in also on a site called Da'at, an article written by Avneria. I don't know if it's posted. An article written by Abneri where he goes into the calculations of the Shemitah year, and there he quotes a document from the time of the Gaonim, which talks about the year 4564, and says that year was Shemitah, which comes out to the year 803, which is the earliest again that we have mention of a document that can actually pinpoint that it mentions the Shemitah year, and we know the exact year of Shemitah, and we know the exact year that we're talking about. Now 4564 is divisible by 7, and based on that, well, not based on this document, but we follow this tradition that the year that's divisible by 7 is the Shemitah year. That's not the reason, but that's the fact. If you divide up the year and it's equally divided by 7, so then you know that you are in the Shemitah year, and that matches. This, as we said, the earliest document that we have over here is from the year 803, and we continue this tradition, as the Rambam says, that the tradition is, we quote him, Shekabola v'maisa amudim gedolim bara v'hem ro'i litos. The Kabbalah and the Maisa, and that was the Masoras, and the way we do, those are amudim gedolim, and that's what we follow, and Hashanah Shemitah Yedua, he as the Rambam continues, the year is known, and that's how it is. So, to sum it all up, the calculation that we use today is Levi'as HaOlam, but this is relatively a later system. Minyan Shtoros was relevant even in Eretz Yisrael. Also, in the British Museum, there is a tablet not on display from the Samaritans, from the Shamanim, of which it mentions a year for Minyan Shtoros. I don't remember the year. I got into the basement, finally got to see all the stuff that's hidden, and so you see that even the Samaritans, they also used Minyan Shtoros, and probably that was used by Eretz Yisrael by everyone at the time in later years, although they also I can't see the Samaritans mentioning Churban Beis HaMikdash, because that's not their Beis HaMikdash, and their own Beis HaMikdash they don't believe existed or was destroyed, so that's no. So they used Minyan Shtoros. So Minyan Shtoros was common until the time of the Gaonim. The Yemenites Ad Hayom Hazet, to this very day, use Minyan Shtoros, and the Ksubas, they use Minyan Shtoros, but the rest of Jewish people have left Minyan Shtoros years ago, and today we use the years for the years mentioned, the system that we have from Bria's HaOlam, which again, so we see archaeologically speaking, the earliest mention we have of that runs probably around in the 5th, 6th century.